Thanks for coming and for the little conversation. We've been in the habit of sort of making a somewhat of an amoeba here to have the conversation as we can be a little closer rather than around the large fireside there. But I'm David Vasquez. I'm a campus pastor at Luther College. For this month, and my wife and I are here during some leading of conversation, and it was just a great invitation and part of the whole community to come and spend part of our sabbatical here. So we're both in sabbatical. My wife's sabbatical focuses on interfaith dialogue and the idea of revolution within biblical text. And so she'll do some sessions on that, Ms. Carla Sumon. And I'm focusing on stories of migration in my sabbatical year. And so looking at migration stories in the biblical text and in people's lives. And one particular element of my sabbatical work is visiting various communities. I'm focusing primarily on rural communities where there's large immigrant populations. In part because I think in the conversation about immigration nationwide, there's very little attention often paid to rural concerns and how immigration impacts rural communities a little differently than other parts. We usually think of the concerns and the opportunities in urban areas and those kind of set the agenda for immigration. And so my interest has been what, you know, particularly in rural communities, but also in the way that people whose primary life experience is that of immigration, that, you know, experience their life as immigrants, how they read the Bible, especially once we think about the fact that most biblical characters are immigrants, or at least experience a significant part of their lives as migration. It's been always intriguing to me that something about the immigrant experience, something about this idea of movement, opens people up to the divine, because most religious stories, not only in the biblical text but in other traditions, a lot of religious stories have at their core a migration story. One of the core stories in Buddhism is the enlightenment of Buddha, who's a prince, and he comes to enlightenment primarily, or begins his path to enlightenment, by traveling around his country that he has sort of not been aware of before. And certainly in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, one of the pillars of Islam, is replicating his journey to Mecca as a central part of an experience of movement. So pilgrimage, movement, migration, we spend a lot of time trying to define it very narrowly, but my interest is when people are on the move, you know, something happens, and so a lot of the stories we record that are central to us come from those moments of movement. Esther is one of those stories. So the last piece I'll say about my particular project that I'm working on is that in the communities I've visited and work with, my interest has been to read a particular story with a group of folks, again, whose primary life experience is that of migration. I could do that pretty much anywhere. I work at a college campus. Most college students are immigrants. You know, they come to the community where we are at a residential school for 4 years, and you know, go through many of the same experiences. But the folks who are very aware of their experience and their identity as immigrants read these stories a little differently, is what I have discovered. And so I've been interested to see what they hear in their story. This is the story of Esther. I just finished a Bible study with a group in Postville, Iowa. That was a site of a large immigration raid a year and a half ago now. And it devastated the community in many ways. And so I met with a group of the folks directly affected by the raid who are still in that community and living kind of in a little limbo. And so their reading of the story is a lot of what has sort of informed the way I approach this text as we read it today. What we'll do is basically just read through the story. We have made our way through about 5 chapters and of the story. So we'll try very briefly to kind of catch up, do a little bit of a summary of it, of where we're at right now, and then begin on it. The first thing is, the book of Esther is really, we talked about the fact that it's really like a soap opera. You know, it's just well suited for film. I'm not sure why we have, well, there's a few films on it, but none of them really have dared to go all the way for it. How funny it would be. So we started out by casting it. So this is the cast. I'll pass it around. But Queen Esther is being played by Elizabeth Taylor. And Sting is Haman, who is the bad guy in the story. Sean Connery is King Ahasuerus, who's the king. We'll talk a little bit about each of them. And then Paul Newman is Mordecai. So, you know, we thought it would be anachronistic about casting them. So everybody's in the prime of their career. So it might be helpful to know a little bit about each of the characters. I'll pass this around so you can, you know, keep in mind the images of who's playing each part. And we will need some readers for the section that we'll do today. We will be, let's see, we'll be starting on page 4, or so the fourth page, they're not numbered, I should have one thing. At the bottom of the right-hand side of page 4, Haman plans to have Mordecai hanged. So, those of you who have been able to kind of be part of the conversation before, let's very quickly sort of tell everybody else where we're at. Let's talk about just some of the main characters. What would you say about King Ahasuerus?
Well, he's been ruling in his kingdom for 3 years, and at the beginning of the story, he throws this very lavish party that lasts 360
days. 180 days,
oh,
so
sorry.
6 months.
I'm already starting to like go with the story and exaggerate. So he throws this 6 month party and then kind of ends it with an even more luxurious 7 day banquet. And on the last day of the banquet, he tells his wife, Queen Vashti, to come, and she refuses, and so kind of this massive like refusal, and he goes to his core group, his consultants, and he says, well, what should I do about this? And they say, well, you can annul the marriage and choose a new wife. So he invites all of the young virgins in the kingdom, beautiful young virgins, to come, and they spend a lot of time pampering themselves, putting oils, and kind of preparing to meet him. And among them is Esther, who wins his favor and becomes the new queen.
Well, that's great. So that's King Esther. That's just chapter one. And then what happens is Esther is chosen by, you know, by the king for her looks after spending all this time in the spa. But one of the critical parts of the story is Esther is a foreigner. She is described as the, you know, having come to the kingdom as a, as an exile, taken by the previous king, and she has to hide her identity as a foreigner, as a Jew. And there's no clarity in the story as to why. But from the beginning, she's told by Mordecai, who is her sort of stepfather. It was her cousin who adopted her, of sorts, when her parents died. Again, we're not told how her parents died. But again, it's another indication in the story that Esther's life has already been kind of difficult. You know, she has to hide her identity. Her parents have died in some uncertain circumstances. And she is adopted by Mordecai. Mordecai then tells her very clearly not to say who she is, even before she goes into the kingdom. She is then selected as queen. And Mordecai still insists that she hide her identity after that. So it says in the textbook, before and after she's been selected. Anybody else? What happens after that, or any other piece that might be helpful to share with folks? That's where we're at now.
When Mordecai saves the king's life by revealing him a plot against him, messing with his eunuchs. So Mordecai goes to Esther and said, you know, tells Esther to tell the king. And by that way, Mordecai starts to get his name known in the king's circle.
One of the aspects that we discussed at the beginning is the story of Esther is used often in the tradition of Purim, which is a Jewish tradition, and many of you may be familiar with it. It's a mix of lots of great celebration. It's a huge celebration within Jewish tradition. There's customs where people come to the synagogue dressed as one of the characters in the story, and they read the entire book of Esther in one sitting. Every time Haman's name comes out, we'll talk about Haman in a second here, everybody boos Haman. He's the bad guy. And then, so the story has in the potential to be, it's very exaggerated in many of its details, lavish parties, you know, random reactions to what people do, very strong violence in it. And so the story continues when Mordecai has saved the king's life, but is in a tangle with Haman. Haman is this hated guy who has become second to the king. And so Haman decides that the best way to deal with this is beneath him, the text says, to deal directly with Mordecai. So he decides instead he's just going to wipe out all of his people. In this case, all of the Jews. You know, that would be his solution. That way he doesn't have to dirty his hands by just killing everybody instead. So again, an exaggeration in the text, but also something that begins to raise some of the real core issues within it. Through comedy and exaggeration and satire, the text really deals with a lot of serious issues. Issues of gender, identity, and also kind of scapegoating a group of people within it. So Haman convinces the king then to pass a law where they will have a chance, anybody, to get rid of all the Jews in the territory. And he initially offers to pay the king for this, but the king decides to do it for free. And one of the key parts of the story that we'll see again in the reading of it today is how the law is formed. The title I've been using for the study has been "The Laws Must Be Adjusted for Those Who Can't Be Trusted." And that's from a tune in VeggieTales. If you've ever seen VeggieTales, they had a great movie on Esther and a whole bunch of great songs. And one of the songs, that's the refrain to it. The idea that throughout the book, the law keeps being adjusted. So what's interesting is we have a biblical text within what we often call the law. You know, people often will look at the first part of the Bible, the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, that's, you know, containing a lot of law. Well, here we have a book that really makes a lot of fun of the law. And the definition of the law we had come up last time is basically whatever pleases the king. Every time anybody tells the king what to do, he never seems to be able to come up with it himself. It's followed by the refrain, and this pleased the king. Things like, you know, get rid of the wife and find a younger one. That seems to please the king and all of his friends. You know, all of these different things that seem to please the king is basically what the law is. So that's where we're at. And then it's discovered what the plot against the Jews is. And Esther needs to then come out and identify herself as a Jew. Even though she's had to hide her identity, it's a moment of truth for her. And then we see this contrast. One of the things that we've been looking at as a different way to read the text from a traditional reading of it is to read it with a lot of suspicion towards Mordecai. Traditionally, the text views, most of the readings of this text view Mordecai, this stepfather, as one of the heroes in the story who's protecting this poor little Esther. But part of my reading of the text with this group of women in Postville really alerted me to their own sense that they did not trust Mordecai from the get-go. And so we've been reading both ways, kind of looking a little bit more charitably towards Mordecai, but then also with more suspicion, and it's been interesting to see the dynamic of that. Any questions before we kind of continue on our reading? We've tried to kind of hopefully give enough of background for folks to feel caught up to the conversation thus far. All right. Well, we will need a couple of narrators. So we're at the bottom of page 4. There are maybe some copies that can be shared back to folks that can know later. At the bottom of page 4, Haman plans to have Mordecai hanged. And we need narrator 1 and 2. And let's see. And we will need Zeresh, who is Mordecai's wife. So we have two people who are willing to be narrators. Okay. So you want to be narrator 2 then? And then narrator 1, somebody else would like to be narrator 1? Okay, you will be Zeresh then. You will be the wife. Sorry to have guys do that. You get to, well, you know, you get to be married to, who is Haman again? Sting? See, it's not that. All right. Okay, so let's start reading.
Narrator 2.
Yep.
Haman went out that day happy and in good spirits. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was infuriated with Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Then he sent and called for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the ministers of the king. Haman added,
"Oh, forgot Haman. Somebody want to be Haman? Go for it, man."
"Even Queen Esther let no one but myself come with the king to the banquet that she prepared. Tomorrow also I am invited by her, together with the king. Yet all this does me no good so long as I see the Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate."
Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him,
"Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the banquet in good spirits."
This advice pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made.
All right, that's when we say the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So, right, anything in the text that sort of caught your eye, your attention, any other background you want to provide as we, or questions that it raised? And I'm not sure that we used to use suspicious so much. It's just, you know, at the beginning we talked about the way the portrayal of men in this book is fairly negative, you know, and we have these self-centered, just like tiny, you know, huge ego, tiny self-reliance and self
insecure,
very insecure man. You know, maybe it's telling, right? And so he's this guy who has to tell his wife how many sons he has. He got into everybody, tells him how many songs he has. Come on, I'm sure his wife's aware. And after he's gone through this whole thing, just like the king did, notice there's parallels. The book uses a lot of parallels and a lot of sort of opposites. And in this case, what does the king do at the beginning of the book? Throw huge parties to make sure everybody knows about the splendor of his wealth. And then we have another guy doing the exact same thing. Haman is mimicking the king. The king has set the standard of what it means to be a man. You show all the stuff you have, you drive around in your big SUV, whatever it is, but he's driving around in a big SUV and he's bothered by this beggar on the road. You know, it doesn't allow him, no matter what he has. It's not enough. All of this isn't good enough until I can step on Mordecai. Mm-hmm.
You know, if this were to become a soap opera or a telenovela, like in Brazil, people can call in and change the story. I think it would be crazy.
To change it in what way? What do you mean?
Yeah. Well, like the telenovelas in Brazil, it's like, do you want Esther to do this or that? And you can call in and like, depending upon the majority and what the opinions are being voiced,
you can get to
write
the story.
You affect the story. Yeah, you write the story, which I think is interesting.
So we'll have to keep that in mind in terms of how we would want to change the direction of the story. So, and for those of you, you know, in some of the previous sessions that. Where Haman is coming back from is that Esther, the queen, has thrown a banquet. Banquets are huge in this part of the book, and in the book as throughout. She's thrown a banquet because she's setting up to go against Haman. But she invited him and the king. So he's all happy about this. You know, absolutely. Don't just suspicious, I'm not sure that he is at all. You know, he is so blinded by his own sort of need for affirmation. Anything else that you noticed on the text before we continue reading? Did you notice how he refers to Mordecai?
The Jew.
The Jew Mordecai. This is the first time that the phrase is used. It's used only a couple of times in the text. But immediately, the way that the text uses it is derogatory. The Jew Mordecai. You know, this is not just identifying him by, you know, his nationality, identity, you know, cultural grouping. It's intended to be derogatory in the way that he is using it, that Haman is using it. And so keep that in mind because we'll see it repeated later. And then the other thing I'll notice is Haman's reactions. Did you notice Haman's reaction to the suggestion? What was his wife's suggestion for how to deal with Mordecai?
He pleased him.
The same thing that happened when the king, that this is the phrase that's throughout. Every time, you know, everybody seems, and pleased with this. Why is not to like? What's not to like, right? This benefits me. Whatever benefits me, pleases me. Right. What do you make of the fact that it is his wife who makes the suggestion about killing Mordecai in this very public way? The reason I asked that question is that the group that I read this with, one of the things that they started out with at the beginning, just having a lot of fun, it was predominantly a group of women, was the fact that, you know, if women ruled the world, this would be different. You know? And so it was interesting for them to kind of come to this point in the story and say, well, you know, what happens when people have power? Is it only initial power? Is it initial gender? So, something to... Again, any reactions or comments about
Well, it just feels to me that the hyperbole is just, it's offensive to me that we're talking about a gallows that's 50 cubits high. I mean, this, the scale of that is just ridiculous to begin with. And the fact that dealing with Mordecai this way seems like it is immediately going to enable him to go to the banquet in good spirits. Oh, this will quickly take care of it. We all understand this is going to make me happy.
And there's the shock of reading this when you actually begin to think about what in this story allows, what kind of a world does the story create where this makes sense? You know, where it doesn't stir within us more. And some of that, I think, has to do with the fact that we're reading a sacred text. And sometimes there is a way in which we approach sacred texts that deadens them. You know, to an extent, we just don't question them enough. So, let's focus on that for a minute. Why 50 cubits? Not the number. But what's the significance, not of the number, but, you know, again, the exaggeration. But what would, if we take that image seriously, what is she proposing by this? What would be the point of this? What is it that would eventually make him please him and let him go happy to the party? Public humiliation of Mordecai, you know. At the beginning, it was below him to deal with Mordecai directly. Now, okay, go for it, you know. And make it very public and show your power as much as you can. At the beginning, Haman may have been a little bit less sure of himself about his power. He was fairly recently promoted. Now, after being invited, just himself and the king, to the queen's palace, maybe he has more power and more certainty. Well, let's continue reading. Again, we have narrator 1 and 2 will continue, and then we need a king and a servant. And I think Haman again. We have, so, king and a servant. Want to be king?
Okay.
All right. And we need somebody to be a servant. Just somebody, I think. I'll read the servant back, we just have one line, so let's go on.
That night the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of records, the annals, and they were read to the king. It was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, who had conspired to assassinate King Ahasuerus. Then the king said,
"What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's servants who attended him said,
"Nothing has been done for him."
"Who is in the court?"
Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. So the king's servants told him,
"Haman is there, standing in the court."
"Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor?"
Haman said to himself,
"Whom would the king wish to honor more than me?"
So Haman said to the king,
"For the man whom the king wishes to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden, with a royal crown on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let him robe the man whom the king wishes to honor, and let him conduct the man on horseback through the open square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor.'"
Then the king said to Haman,
"Quickly, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to the Jew, Mordecai, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned."
Shakespearean.
So Haman took the robes and the horse and robed Mordecai and led him riding through the open square of the city, proclaiming,
"Thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor."
Oh, come on. Give that another try. How do you think it's done?
"Thus shall it be done for the man
whom the king wishes to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. But Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends at his end that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife, Zeresh, said to him,
"If Mordecai..." for whom your downfall has begun is of the Jewish people, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him.
Hey, so we might put a bit there. Just wanted to unpack it. Anything that kind of caught your attention? Let's focus maybe at the beginning part there, on the first couple of paragraphs, and anything in there that... Actually, no, any part of it that kind of stood out to you. Let's just sort of cut it out and we'll talk through it.
I think it was interesting when he was talking about, you know, let the robes that the king has worn be given. Like, placing, like, what is of value?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone to give the service of the king who touched everything that turned to gold.
Midas. And in some ways, this is what's happening to Haman. You know, everything, he has this great plan. Who else would the king want to honor but me? And all of a sudden, it's bad. And he wants to play king. He's thinking this is for himself. So he wants to wear the clothes of the king of war. It's the latest style. Is it a critique of modern consumerism? If he wants to wear the latest fashion? Whatever the actors are wearing.
It's brilliant writing. I mean, it's almost Shakespearean. The text is just so, every word is important, and it's just incredible turn of phrase, and the way it moves, it's just brilliant writing.
It is incredible. And the thing is that, and this is what is significant when you look at different translations, because it's a really difficult work to translate, because there's so much in it. There's all of these language connections that even in translation we miss because the original text would have played on them in the way that trying to translate something like Shakespeare is fairly difficult. But you're right. I mean, I think it's... Are there particular things you notice that are really kind of fun or cool?
Seems like his wife is just like giving up, like, good luck, buddy.
Exactly. I know, you know, this has happened in just a shorter time. And all these things are happening so quickly. And she's gone from, well, you'll be happy as soon as we hang him. And then going, oh, no. Back off. It's like, you better know. And you begin to have the sense. She is the oracle. You know? She is the one that's foretelling. The one who knows before the guy does. What's really going to happen, you know?
Did she not know he was a Jew before this? She says, if he's a Jew.
Yeah, that's an interesting, but I think why the language specifically kind of question, it puts it, it phrases it in the word of a question, I'm not exactly sure.
She doesn't really phrase it as a question, but it's basically, well, if he's a Jew, you don't have a chance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if Mordecai is of the Jewish people, she associates in some way whatever Mordecai, and again, it's playing on a stereotype. The stereotype has been negative until now. The condemnation of the Jews comes because of Mordecai. So a bad experience with one immigrant all of a sudden makes all the immigrants look the same. You know, Haman is wanting to generalize and use a stereotype. But now the stereotype is working backwards. If he is one of these people, then that automatically means all of these people have lots of power during the trouble. So, you know, it's playing with the stereotype itself.
Well, it makes me wonder whether in the earlier thing about the gallows, I mean, is the transition real? Is it just a dramatic device, or is she maybe mocking him at the first round?
Say that again. So go ahead and say more about that, because I'm not sure about it.
Well, there could be, I mean, it reads like a play, and there's various interpretations you could put on the character, right? And so the one possibility is that Zeresh, in fact, switched her mind, like in the beginning, thought, yeah, go ahead and do this, you'll win, and you'll use this gallows for Mordecai, but then this flip-flop at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it could be that she didn't shift,
mm-hmm.
but that this final statement represents her feeling all along.
You know, that's a hilarious interpretation of it. So think about that. So let's go back to the phrase that Suresh has said. So if somebody, who's Suresh again? Can you read that mockingly? Go back to where she tells him what to do.
I didn't know it was actually the actress.
Oh, my God. Come on. You have it in you. So,
you know, they didn't ask me to be in the
school. For a reason.
Goodness.
thing. What if he has said? If we go back to, no, so let a gallows 50 cubits high be, you know, be made.
And in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and meet his parents.
So yeah, I think it totally is very, that's a great turn on it.
But then why would it be all of his friends too? Right above there it says, then his wife Zeresh and all of his friends said to him.
Mm-hmm.
So would all of his friends be mocking him too? I mean, that's almost like a Greek chorus.
Well, you know, it feels to me that I have had the sense,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the story that keeps coming to my mind is the emperor's new clothes.
Okay.
And it sort of feels like there is the possible undercurrent,
mm-hmm.
the subtext here, that everybody knows that they're playing on his insecurity. They're making him, like the emperor who really was naked, feel like he was beautifully robed and continue to feed his desire to preen,
then
let him just kind of trip once it becomes clear that he's...
You know, and it's really difficult to know, to some extent, you know, the use of satire and all of this stuff. We certainly have evidence of it in lots of other writings. And so to what extent would it be satirical, you know? Is it intended to be where his wife is really thinking this is like an extremely ridiculous idea, and he takes it seriously, you know? She's just like, I mean, come on, get over yourself, you know? You already got everything, forget about the guy. And then gives this sort of over-the-top ridiculous idea, and he takes it seriously and goes off to do it. So that's a great, this is the kind of stuff I think is most fun to do this. Couple of other things on the text here I'll point out, and then, you know, again, just invite others to continue. But one of the issues back to the idea of the way that she phrases, Teresh phrases Mordecai's association with being Jewish, is the fact that the text of Esther does not mention God. It's one of the only book in the Bible where God is never mentioned, never directly addressed. But the presence of God, if any, happens in these chances. There's a really interesting play with the idea of chance and things that just happen. You know, notice that night the king just couldn't sleep. Again, a comedy of the way that the king is portrayed. What does he do when he can't go to sleep?
That is history, right?
He wants to know about himself, you know? Can you tell me what I've been up to lately? You know, I mean, this is what will help him go to sleep, is to hear stories about himself. And so they go back and dig him out, and they start telling him these stories. And then they pull out the story of Mordecai, who saved his life. And he wonders, did we do anything for that guy? You know? And the thing is that when that's told earlier, the king is there. He knows. He knows when they entered it. And he did nothing. Why didn't he do something for Mordecai then, who saved his life? Was it because he was a foreigner? You know, was it because he was a Jew who was, I mean, at that point, the edict had not been done against the Jews, so it's unclear. But regardless of why it was, that didn't happen. So that's one coincidence. The king can't sleep. At that same middle of the night, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things that you're supposed to have picked up on is Haman just got back from this huge banquet in the middle of, you know, late, I'm sure. They've been drinking and partying till late. Gets home, tells everybody about all of his greatness, and then about his frustrations. And he cannot go to sleep himself either. What keeps men up at night? Trying to figure out, one, wanting to hear stories about himself, and the other one, concerned because he doesn't have enough yet. He hasn't killed enough people. And he can't wait till the next morning to do it. He's already sent people to go off and build a gallows. And even before asking the king, and then goes in to ask permission of the king, and he's walking around the palace hoping the king is up. You know, and this is at night. And then the coincidence comes in. So you see this chance happening at different points in the story. And this is where we see the presence of God. The reference to the Jews and to the Jewish people then becomes a reference to the presence of God acting in the text. The role of chance is significant because I mentioned the festival of Purim, which the name comes from the book itself. We'll come to that at the end of the book. But it comes from the word for chance or for lot, when you cast lots. When he decided to destroy the Jews, cast lots to figure out the date on which they would be destroyed. And so it was by chance, you know, by the lot, by the draw of lot that he would decide when to destroy them, And now we see chance working against him in the timing of the king's, you know, insomnia, and then by chance, just then, Haven happens to come in and be called in, and then things kind of get upset. Anything else in that in those paragraphs that you noted?
Well, I just want to, I don't know if this is valid in terms of the whole tradition in biblical literature about night visitations and dreams, and maybe even though God's not mentioned, the fact that the king, it's nighttime, the king can't sleep, and so the servant comes in and begins to read. Maybe that's the equivalent in Esther of that kind of nighttime sort of epiphany. You know, now this really self-centered guy who didn't think to do anything to honor the man who'd saved his life. Now there's like the equivalent of a visitation.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's...
To realize that he should have done something for Mordecai, and then sort of at that precise moment, exactly. There's this chance that all of a sudden he's thinking, okay, well, what am I going to do? And Haman provides the answer for what to do for the men whom the king wants to honor. What do you think of Haman's response? Whom would the king wish to honor more than me? This book is written in a predominantly very male-dominated society. I mean, that this comes out of a culture at a time in which, you know, that would have been kind of more standard. So what do you make of this portrayal of men in the story, in the text? How would it have played in a culture that tended to be fairly protective of men?
Well, he's pretty cocky. I mean, was he like actually a favorite of the king? Or is that, so does he have that kind of power already, or is that just something to protect about himself?
He does. He's second to the king. The king has made him second only to himself. And then he was invited to this banquet by Esther, which is actually a setup for him.
Okay.
But he doesn't know that yet. So he does have the power, but you know, the problem is it's not sufficient. He's still very cocky.
Yeah.
And he's cocky in thinking that the king cannot want to honor anybody else.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, any other things on here before we read a little more? Let's see what we're doing time. We've got a few minutes yet. One of the key elements in the book are reversals, and they happen repeatedly. Last session we talked about the idea of a chiastic structure. This is a mirror-like structure where everything that happens sort of in one end happens on the other end, the opposite of it, and you see that throughout the book. One of those mirror images is what happens to to Haman after having spent the entire day, instead of hanging Mordecai, he spent the entire day carrying him around on a horse. I mean, that image is just hilarious, you know? Of him walking around the entire city hollering repeatedly, you know, this is what the king does to anybody who wants to honor. And so he's going home. I mean, imagine what he's feeling like as he walks home that day. And, you know, to get the very nice news from his wife of saying, you know, give it up, man. And, but the way he was walking home, the description, Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. This was the description of Mordecai just two chapters earlier, when he found out the edict that Haman had, you know, managed to get the king to pass, you know, to destroy all the Jews. It was Mordecai who was walking around the city with ash on his head and mourning throughout the city. This is what drew attention to Esther to know that he was out there and what was going on. She was sort of out of the loop, living inside the castle to what was going on outside. And now we see this reversal. In two chapters earlier, Haman's at the top of his game, he's controlling everything, he's issuing laws left and right, and he's got all his wealth, and Mordecai's out on the streets. And now we have the opposite. Mordecai is the one on the horse with the nice clothes, and Haman is going home ashamed and in mourning.
So would this be as public a display of shame as had been his intention for the public nature of the treatment of Mordecai that he hoped for?
Oh,
would this have
yeah.
been very publicly mm-hmm. seen, that he would have been walking with his head down in the ashes and so on?
You mean Mordecai's or Haman's now? Oh, yeah. I mean, anything. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, but his shame is all internal. It's all self-projected. Or it's only what he himself is placing on him.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because in his world,
there's not room for more than one person to have favor. If someone else has favor, it automatically takes it from him. Whereas for Mordecai, when he was walking home, it was an outward event that was going to directly affect him.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question, so maybe if you want to say a little bit more about it. Or maybe I'll say one thing, and then that just comes to, I really appreciate that comment that you said as well, about in Haman's world, there's no room for any other favorite. There's only one chosen. I did some writing on the story of Ishmael and Isaac, or the two sons of Jacob, and, Abraham, and where the assumption is that there's no other side to chosen. If you're going to choose Isaac, then Ishmael's out the door. And this is the assumption within the culture. But the biblical stories continually show that that's not the case. God cares for Ishmael as he cares for Isaac. And in this case, that's an interesting note. So that Haman comes into the, views the world as a competitive place where there's only room for one at the top. The king can't possibly have any other favorites because it means he's losing favor. In terms of the shame, what you mentioned that brings to mind for me is the idea that Mordecai's shame was very public in the sense that it was clear, not so much shame as grief, mourning. There is shame in part because he is at fault for why this has come upon the Jews. But his would have been very visual. They express grief by physically putting ash on them, tearing, rendering their clothes and all these things and walking around. Haman's is not physical. He's probably still wearing nice clothes, but he's been shamed by having to walk all over town yelling and carrying Mordecai, so that's mortified him all the way through. And now his shame, I don't think there's anything physical, other than why his face doesn't look that good. He's covered his face. What we're told is, he has covered his face physically just so that nobody sees him anymore. He's had enough humiliation for the day. Once again, he gets
home. It just felt like there was a bit of parallelism there because the language actually is saying, yeah, he hurried to his house, which gives you the sense that maybe he was
on
the sly, but that he was mourning and that his head was covered. He chose to do this, and it just seems to carry the parallelism to the same sort of outward signs of grief that you have.
And that comes very natural, in the sense that we do. I don't want to be seen. How our bodies express what we are feeling. This is a great conversation, and this is exactly what we're open. So any other things on this text before we kind of continue reading? All right. Let's look at the next part of it then, Haman's downfall. And let me see, I think we have the same, except for Esther now. We need Esther. And Esther saw that.
I'll be Esther.
All right. Narrator 2, I think, just start out again.
Yes. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman off to the banquet that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. On the second day, as they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther,
"What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled."
We'll stop there just for a second for a couple of background things. There's already been one banquet that Esther has offered. Esther has decided to come out, tell who she is as a Jew in order to save her people, or at least give it a shot. Even though it's against the law, she specifically says, "This is against the law for me to come out. I'm going to risk my life." She decides to do that. To do that, she's asked the people to fast. So again, you have a contrast between the people out fasting, and then she is going to figure out a way. We're not told what she's going to do, but she's got a plan. The first part of her plan is she invites the king and, like we saw, Haman to a banquet and has this great banquet for them. Drinking is perennial throughout this book. They're constantly drinking and having a merry time. And so she holds the party, and the king has already twice told her, "What would you like? Tell me. I'll give you whatever you want up to half of my kingdom." So we discussed that quite a bit last time, but he's already offered this twice. And she just says, "My only request is that you come back again for another party." And so she's sort of playing along with it and softening him up. She hasn't quite told him what she wants. So that is background. And so now the king has yet again offered half of his kingdom.
What if he waits? It's the second day. That takes kind of insinuating that they have this whole thing.
feast that they feasted for 2 days?
And in between, you know, because remember, the first feast, I mean, this has been like a packed day. The first feast happened on his way home. Haman is fuming because of Mordecai, makes plans to get rid of him. That same night, ends up with his plans being totally turned around. During the day, he's been parading Mordecai. He gets home. He's worn out. He wants to do nothing with anybody. His wife just told him to give it up. And so he's like hiding under his bed. When the eunuchs come to get him to go to another party, I mean, by this point, he's just like, oh, thanks. Okay, so. All
right. Then Queen Esther answered,
"If I have won your favor, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me. That is my petition. And the lives of my people, that is my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have held my peace. But no enemy can compensate for this damage to the king."
Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther,
"Who is he, and where is he, who has presumed to do this?"
"A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman."
Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. The king rose from his feast in wrath and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that the king had determined to destroy him. When the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman had thrown himself on the couch where Esther was reclining, and the king said,
"Will he even assault the queen in my presence? In my own house?"
As the words left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said,
"Look, the very gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose words saved the king, stands at Haman's house, 50 cubits high.
Hang him on it."
So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the anger of the king abated.
Oh, God. Who writes this stuff, right?
Well, that's a good question. Who did write it?
Well, you know, authorship of anything in the Bible is pretty, you know, difficult to identify. There's always, you know, traditional ascribings of text to different authors, but with a book like Esther, most of the biblical text started as oral tradition, and not only until later would have been written up. And so the thing is, the kind of story that got perfected around the fire, and eventually somebody penned it down. And so that's not to say that this is not an inspired text, and that God's, you know, hand is in the, you know, this is our conviction of faith about the origin of the text, that it contains. Martin Luther talked about the idea that we encounter the Christ child in these texts, that we encounter God in these texts. But in terms of the specific authorship, it really is, I mean, the creativity, the freedom of the story. And one of the issues we dealt with a lot at the beginning is the danger of reading these texts literally. I mean, we need to take them seriously, but not necessarily literally, because this is a dangerous text to take literally. And we'll see that even more as we go through and we get these exaggerated responses. But anything further on that? Did you have anything more in authorship? Or
No, I'm just curious if you had any particular insights. Or mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this time frame. It's like, you know, just from the events that are related in it, that is likely to have been written after the exile, because it makes a reference to the exile, that the, you know, what it gives some very specific sort of historical details, but they don't quite match historical facts. So I don't think, my conviction personally is not that the text was ever intended to be history, but to really be sort of true. An Old Testament professor had always said, you know, all the stories in the Bible are true, and some of them even happen. You know, and so this may not necessarily be one of the stories that, in my moral view, that specifically happened in this way, but it is something that happens regularly. And this has become true and very clear to me when we try to then think about the use of the law by those in power to their own purposes and what pleases them. Esther learns, as a person without much power, to use the power she has. She has decided to do something that goes against the law, and she knows it. But she knows what the law is. What is the law defined as in the book so far? What is the law? So what does she tell the king to do? If it pleases the king. So she has learned to use the system that's there to the extent that she's able to. And so I think the book raises serious questions about what do people without power do? People who are confronted by laws. You know, we tend to, you know, that the laws are created, what the book says is the laws ultimately are often created by those in power to please those in power. And they often have the effect of disenfranchising others who don't have power. And so what are they to do? It's difficult because there is that spectrum between saying who's going to respect the law. This was a huge part of the conversation with this group of women in Potsdam, particularly because they are defined externally primarily as people who have violated the law, as if that was what their life was all about. That single fact that they had crossed the border without documents defined their entire life. And there was no way in the system for them to redeem that, ever. And so, how are they to live in a system that doesn't allow room for that? And the struggle for them is people who are very much people of faith, who follow every rule, who follow everything, know that they've had to make a decision out of desperation. And so hearing this in the biblical text, which is not a normal story they'll hear in the Bible, or not in the way that they often hear the Bible or is told to them, you know, where as people of faith, what we do is we follow the law. Now, the text isn't necessarily suggesting no laws matter, everything out the window, but at least it does, through comedy, exaggeration, and some very strong poignancy, challenges, you know, whether all laws are fair.
But I think it's interesting in this case, too, that she isn't the one who is directly making this suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't say, go hang Haman on the gallows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's one of the king's own eunuchs who actually comes up with the idea. She just sort of spells out the offense,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
allows the king's own self-interest to sort of allow it to mount, and then the suggestion comes also from elsewhere. At
mm-hmm.
least that's what the text makes it look like.
She does not have the authority to make the law, so you're right. What she does, later on that changes because the king comes back to her. She specifically asks her to do this, to figure out the law, because this king seems kind of, you know, he doesn't seem to be very able to write law. But what she asked for is just her life. The language of this was both liberating and painful for this group of women I work with. Because note what Esther says, and imagine themselves speaking, because they said, if I could say this to Obama, if I have won your favor by my work, by my life, by my children, by paying my taxes, by following every single rule, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me. Just let me live. And their sense is that that's what hangs in the balance for many of them. They have left their home countries and their lives because of desperation, in the sense that there are no alternatives for themselves and for their children. And so that their desire is Esther, simply to have their life be given. Any other comments in here on this text? We are running a little short on time, but I have another 5 minutes or so.
I'm just wondering, is Haman always this dispensable to the king? Like, did he ever have power? Because by the end, he's just like, oh yeah, it's super cool. But was that always how he felt towards him, or was it sort of when he was overshadowed by?
Mm-hmm.
By Mordecai somehow.
You know, Haman just sort of comes out of the blue. There's not a lot of background on him. You know, all of a sudden he's introduced to somebody that the king decides to make that second to himself. And again, the king is fairly new. He's only been in the kingdom for 3 years. And so it's unclear. But there's definitely a sense that people, in general, are dispensable to him. You know? He dispensed with Vashti. You know, didn't do what he wanted. Dispensed with her. Certainly Haman's crime, you know, seems to be significant in his eyes, especially once he thinks that he's now going, you know, trying to attack, you know, he's trying to beg for his life, but Esther and the king misinterprets that.
Had the king agreed to persecute the Jews?
Yeah, Haman had made a suggestion. This is why Esther's pointing to what. What Haman had suggested the king, to the king was because he decided it was beneath him to kill Mordecai himself. This you know, sort of anger between him and Mordecai. Then he decided he would get rid of all the Jews, and his plan was to ask the king to let him, you know, to get rid of all the Jews. And the way that law is written is also really significant, or the way that he comes to tell him. He says there are these sneaky people, you know, just weird people among us that don't follow our laws. You know, they're different from us. And if you read the language, it sounds very much the way that throughout history, you know, the outsiders have been portrayed, you know, as just dangerous and scary. And so that's when he says, let's change the law because they just can't be trusted. And the law that he proposes, the king just says, do whatever you think is right. You know, go ahead. So he writes this edict that goes out, and it uses the same language that Esther is using to destroy, kill, and annihilate all Jews, young and old, men and women. You know, this is what the law is and goes throughout the land. Another significant element here is the role again of this strange role to celebration and drinking. You know, at the beginning you see there, as they were drinking wine, this is like the preface to every encounter in the book, at the beginning of the section we just read. You know, on the second day, as they were drinking wine, oh, evidently they party for 2 days, the king again said to Esther, and then, you know, they go into the whole thing. The only time that the feasting stops is when, after Esther has spoken. You know, that's when the king finally stops his party. I'm trying to think where the language is a little different in this version. Okay, they're in the kingdom, the king answered. Lissy and the phone. Oh, the king rose from the feast. Well, the translation is not very good. The king rose from the feast in wrath and went into the palace. And the actual more literal translation from the Hebrew is the king stopped drinking, got up from his kingdom. And that's the first time that happens in the text, when drinking specifically stops. Like there's a sobering moment, a realization that, you know, something serious is at stake. In this edict that has been sent against Esther and her people. Does that answer your question? Any other comments or questions?
It has me a little curious, just thinking her question about how quickly Haman himself rose to power and then how dispensable Mordecai might be later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because maybe Haman's rise to power is the exact same way as Mordecai's. Maybe he saved the king's life at one point and, you know, 5 months later, the king's reading through the annals and sees Haman. No, he saved my life. I should honor him and make him second to me. And then, mm-hmm. So it just has me wondering maybe how secure Mordecai's position is,
mm-hmm.
you know, later.
Exactly. And you know, the book ends much before anything else would happen, you know, in the story. But again, I think that what's significant in it is this clear sense that you know, while it does not specifically mention God, it does leave this clarity about the fact that power and wealth are not security. You can't equate the two. You know, it's trying to really at least raise the question about where our safety and security comes from. You know, Haman's own insecurity couldn't be alleviated with anything. It wasn't wealth, it was a hole big enough, too big to be filled with anything. But we're about to begin worship in just a few minutes, so I want to thank you all very much for your participation in this reading. I hope that our conversation has encouraged you to read the rest of the book of Esther. It's a very quick read. Feel free, if you'd like to keep a copy of this, to do so. Otherwise, we'll keep them for the next time that we read together and we can discuss them and say the way you like to do that. Thank you.